Welcome to American Dream. I'm your host, Tina Richards. The Bush administration is about ready to enter the Twilight Zone period where every day a new person disappears. This according to a former aide to George H.W. Bush. From Donald Rumsfeld to the latest exodus of the Townsend from the Homeland Security Advisor, there has been a mass exodus of people leaving the Bush administration. Is this typical for an administration, or is this particular to George Bush? To discuss this tonight, we have Dr. Craig Holman with the Public Citizens Congress Watch.
Hello.
Hello. And Brian Darling, Director, U.S. Senate Relations, Government Relations, the Heritage Foundation.
Thanks for having me on.
And Professor William Gulston, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So is this something that is typical for most presidential last years?
Or, yeah, I think it is. I mean, President Bush has entered the final phases of his administration. You know, he's been termed a lame duck because he only has about a year left that he'll be in office. So it's natural that a lot of the people that have been working for the Bush administration would take this time, this opportunity now, to move on to other things. We know that Karl Rove has moved on and is now a pundit. He's on TV. He's writing for Newsweek. Tony Snow had some health problems and left as press secretary. And others have left the administration to move on and start their next phase of their careers. I mean, they obviously know that this administration will end in a year, and pretty much no matter what happens, they probably won't stay on even if a Republican wins the presidency. A new president will want to have their own cabinet. They'll want to have their own people advising them, many people that advise them on the campaign. So I think it's pretty natural what's happening with the Bush administration. It just seems like a lot of people are resigning more than in past administrations because I think it happened so quickly.
I'd like to add, well, the turnover is certainly natural, and it happens at the end of every administration. Certainly not to this extent. I mean, we've almost got about a year left of this administration, and the turnover we've seen have been some of the principal architects.
Townsend, I mean,
or Karl Rove. I mean, we're not talking about your typical type of turnover here. We're talking about an administration that does appear to be falling apart. When you take a look at poll results when it comes to the Bush administration, I mean, Bush has been one of the most polarizing presidents we've seen in the U.S. since mass polling began. And it's reflecting in the way the administration, not only the administration falling apart, take a look at Congress. In this year alone, we've had 18 Republican members of Congress announce they're leaving too.
How many Democrats?
Many fewer, about four or five, but there's been 18 Republicans that are on the
large discrepancy.
Yep, and we're talking about key Republicans. I mean, just a couple days ago, Trent Lott, who is the number two person, really, in the Senate, announced that he's going to leave as well. So this is not turnover as normal. This is a falling apart of the administration.
What is slightly unusual is that in the second term, and even quite recently, President Bush has been able to attract some first-rate people to take over the jobs. Arguably, as a matter of fact.
Such as?
Well, such as the new Attorney General, such as the new Secretary of Defense, such as the pretty new Treasury Secretary. I think that the personnel in the second term of this presidency have, on balance, been stronger than the people who staffed the first term, and that is very unusual.
If you look at the first versus the second term, if you look at the Secretary of State, Colin Powell for Condoleezza Rice, you would say that's a step up.
Well, that is the single most important exception, but I will say this. Secretary Rice may not be Secretary Powell's equal in experience, but she certainly is much closer to the president, and therefore she has been much more effective in some respects. Secretary Powell, for example, was interested from day one in doing something about talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That was an unpopular position in the administration. He was never able to persuade the president to do that. Secretary Rice was able to do that. I'll give you another example. Secretary Powell, from day one, wanted to adopt a stance of negotiation with North Korea to do something about their nuclear program. The President of the United States, almost the day he took office, told the Secretary of State not to do that. And it took Secretary Rice to persuade the President to enter the negotiating track. So she has been more effective than Secretary Powell.
So versus first term or second term, or just specifically these last, this last 2 years, really since the 06 is when I think the majority of the people have started, starting with Donald Rumsfeld.
Right, and I want to point out, I mean, what do we have that coincides with the last 2 years of this administration? And that is suddenly a huge popular voter revolt against Republicans in Congress and the Bush administration in specific. We saw, what was it, 30 new Democrats ushered into Congress in the 2006 elections. Both chambers unexpectedly thrown into the Democratic camps because of the significance and the deep-seated hostility that voters are now showing towards the Bush administration. So, you know, this is not a change as normal. This is a change because Republican leaders, both in Congress and the administration, do sense a huge change is about to happen in 2008.
Let me make two quick points on that. First of all, I think part of it is burnout. I think when a president's in office for the period of time that President Bush has been in office, I think people get tired of that president. It happened with President Clinton to an extent. It happened with even Ronald Reagan. I mean, you look back and people tend to get tired of the same individual being in office, and they're already looking forward to the next presidency. Look at what President Bush has done. He's done some unprecedented things electorally. He won in 2000. In 2002, he used the presidency, and he actually campaigned out for congressional candidates, which hadn't been done in the past, very aggressively, and he actually helped Republicans pick up seats in the House and Senate. 2004, he won a stunning victory and did an excellent job after the war in Iraq had started, showing that at that time the Iraq war was not unpopular. Obviously, in 2006, it was the one area that people can look to see President Bush not doing a good job. Things didn't go well, and Republicans suffered defeats. But In looking forward to the next election is going to be about two things. I think potentially it's going to be about Hillary Clinton if she becomes a nominee, which right now I would say she's the front runner. I mean, she's doing really well, and if she doesn't stumble in Iowa or New Hampshire, she should be the nominee. So it's going to be about Hillary Clinton, and it's going to be partially about George Bush because the Democrats are running a campaign right now against George Bush and not running against any of the candidates that are running on the Republican side. So It's we'll see what happens in the future, but President Bush, notwithstanding his setbacks in 2006 and the resignations that definitely show a lot of burnout, I think, on the part of some of the people that were in the administration and on the part of the American people.
They weren't all burnouts. You look at the accounting of Hal Rumsfeld. It was a
throwout.
Yeah,
that was a meeting at the table,
sure.
According to the recent book that came out regarding that. It was, it's the dissent in Bush's inner circle that he had a private dinner party. He did a polling of his top aides, and all but three, including himself and Rove, said, no, he needs to be gone.
Right. Well, what's the problem in Iraq? I mean, we're seeing a problem on the part of the political solution. We're not having political progress in Iraq. The military solution, the military invasion of Iraq was successful. I don't think there's any dispute that the initial invasion of Iraq showed that the American military force would do better than anybody had expected. And then you look furthermore to what has happened in the surge. Things are going better now. We haven't lost military battles. So militarily, if you purely look at it in that phase, Rumsfeld did some good things. So obviously, on the other end, on the political side, we've had huge problems. And I know that the president and others are deeply concerned about the lack of political progress in Iraq. But you can't really hang a lot of the problems on all the problems of what happened in Iraq on put that on Donald Rumsfeld's shoulders.
I think that was part of it. There was many reasons why different people left. I don't think anybody's disputing why Tony Snow left.
But I do want to emphasize, you can hang the problems with Iraq on the Bush administration. And voters, in fact, are doing that. We're not talking about burnout here. We're not talking about Republican leaders who are just getting bored with being in office. We're talking about a sense throughout the country that the Iraq war has been a disaster. for the United States, let alone for Iraq, and that it looks like it is a quagmire that we're going to have a very difficult time getting out of. Voters in the last poll have indicated that Iraq, of course, is the number one consideration that they're going to think about when they go into the voting booth in 2008.
Oh, no, so, 2006 had a lot of ethics.
2006 had ethics. And, by the way, ethics did rate above, just a notch, above the Iraq War,
yes,
which surprised me. I focus on ethics, so, you know, that was exciting for me. But what we have seen is it is very true that Bush, at least won the presidency in 2004 and did so on the basis of a superior campaign, quite frankly. And at that point, voters were not that incensed about Iraq. There was a belief that perhaps we were doing something constructive there. But in the time after 2004, it became clear there were no weapons of mass destruction. It became clear that the government had deceived us in terms of why we're going to Iraq. And it's become increasingly clear that this war in Iraq is not going to end satisfactorily. And it's the Bush administration that is taking the brunt of that.
But yeah, I give President Bush some credit where things have gone well. For example, since September 11th, we've had no domestic attacks in the United States in the over 5 years since September 11th. And that's something that President Bush can get some credit for. We've done very well in Afghanistan. Obviously, there are problems there also. But Afghanistan has been a success, and Iraq obviously hasn't been unmitigated success. I mean, things are going poorly, very poorly in the political side, and President Bush concedes that. But overall, President Bush is fighting what he calls a global war on terror, and Iraq is merely one front, and it's definitely the most prominent front, and it's a front that people focus on here in the United States. But I think the American people feel good in one sense that we are doing a good job of protecting the homeland from threats abroad.
And I'd like to go ahead and stop there. And we did speak with Professor Ginsburg and with Richard Hellman. And so if we could see the package.
Some of this is the normal change as people, particularly in the executive branch, leave toward the beginning of the last year of an administration. They have done about what they can. They're tired. They're kind of burned out. And they go ahead to other work in the private sector and in the famous phrase to spend more time with their family. Now, of course, in the Congress, the departure of many Republicans signals a fear that the Republicans are not going to recover the House or the Senate, and that the Democrats are going to increase their lead in both houses, increase their majority in both houses. With more than a year left until the elections, I am not so sure. If, in fact, the Iraq War is going better than it was, and if, in fact, the economy looks good, as it may hopefully still recover from some of the ups and downs that we have experienced, and if the American public comes to feel a little better about the situation, the Republicans may not do so badly. But again, as I said before, it is a time of change, and it is very difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen next month, much less 13 months from now.
We're now in the almost in the final year of the Bush administration, and as often happens, we're seeing a great many resignations, many changes in government. This is very typical in the United States. During the last year, many staffers, as the expression goes, jump ship. They feel that their days of exercising power are coming to an end, and that it's now time to move on and seek other opportunities. So quite a number of Bush administration appointees have left. There are many new faces at the White House. This is a standard phenomenon in the United States. We saw the same thing at the end of the Clinton administration, at the end of the Bush 1 administration. This happens at the end of every presidency. Now, the president is doing what presidents usually do at this time as well. The president is engaged in diplomatic maneuvers. President Bush has organized a peace conference between the Palestinians and Israelis. has invited leaders of a number of Arab states. Again, this is fairly typical. Usually by the last year of an administration, the president has no further domestic agenda. Whatever he has set out to accomplish, he either has accomplished or hasn't accomplished.
So, Professor Gulston, has he accomplished or not accomplished? Is this the end of it?
Well, I don't expect major new domestic initiatives out of the administration. The president may propose some in the State of the Union, but it would be a stunning reversal if any of them actually got enacted.
Is this part of the exodus that we're seeing then?
Look, if you're interested in domestic policy, I was in a White House, the Clinton White House, doing domestic policy, and there is a time to sow, a time to harvest, and then a time to get into the house for a few months for the winter and wait for the growing season to start again. And this is not a time to sow new seeds or even to harvest old ones. I will say one other thing, and that is, if I were the president, I would be disappointed with the results of my second term on the domestic front. President Bush in 2005 hoped for a fundamental reform of Social Security, which he did not achieve. A year later, he hoped for a fundamental, comprehensive new approach to immigration policy, and he didn't achieve that either. So the first term was a whirlwind of activity. The second term, by contrast, has been gridlock and stagnation on many fronts.
I'd like to add, if I could, from a political perspective, I mean, that sounds like a real condemnation for the prospects of Republican election results coming up in 2008. The war, as we know, is already the number one issue that voters have on their minds and have indicated that they're going to consider that when they go into the polling booth. The two other issues are the economy and health care, the two major domestic issues. At this point, the Bush administration has not excelled in either of those areas, and in fact, you know, health care, there just is none.
I think that was the economic advisor Hubbard, private health care accounts.
And
he also was behind the Social Security, which also failed.
And if there are going to be no new initiatives by the Bush administration, as Dr. Ginsburg had indicated earlier, these are the three issues that are going to go into the 2008 elections, that voters are going to determine if they're going to vote Republican or Democrat. And all three of them, at this point, are failures for the Bush administration.
Well, I would disagree. I would say that on the issue of health care, I mean, the candidates running in the Democrat side right now are proposing a government-based solution, basically a move towards socialized medicine. I don't think the American people like that. If you look at what the Bush administration has done, they've introduced health savings accounts, some private accounts for people to put money in so they can have some control over how they spend their own money. And the bottom line is the American people should be attracted to a conservative message, which is that individuals should be allowed to make their own health care decisions. Individuals should be allowed to choose the doctor they want to see, not the government. So taking that decision away from an individual, as many of the Democrat proposals might do, would be problematic, and I don't think it would be accepted. And also, if you look at the situation in Canada, I always joke that if the United States socializes medicine like Canada and Europe has done, where are the Canadians going to go to get their health care? Because many of them are coming to the United States now to get health care because we have such a good system, even though it's not perfect.
Well, going back to the people leaving the Bush administration, because many of these topics, we could devote whole shows into just that topic, and we actually have. So, but going back into this, is there some leverage there that the domestic policy's time is over? There's not going to be anything done in the next 13 months, and that's partly of why people are leaving
sure.
from that
Sure, no, I think
reason.
There is a very limited window to get much done, but there is an opportunity for President Bush to talk about some issues, maybe tax simplification, simplifying the tax code. I think there's bipartisan support for a move to simplify the tax code. I know Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has talked quite a bit about simplifying the tax code, and Republicans also support it, so there could be a bipartisan effort or discussion, at least start the discussion about simplifying the tax code to make it easier for people to pay their taxes and take the government, a lot of the government inefficiency that is involved in that. Also on judges, you never know what's going to happen in the Supreme Court. There may be an opportunity for the president to make another Supreme Court nomination. We know that would be a bloodbath politically, and it would be very difficult to get anybody in that position. But there's an opportunity with judges for the president to nominate and get confirmed a few more good judges, conservative judges, while he's still president. So there are some opportunities.
No, and speaking of that, what did you think of the recent, during the break for the Thanksgiving,
sure.
Senate staying in session
yes.
to so that there could be no recess
sure.
appointments.
Yeah, I used to work in the Senate. I understand how it works, and the Senate is staying in sessions to prevent the president from making recess appointments, which is he's constitutionally allowed to do when the Senate's in recess, so the Senate isn't going into recess.
Obviously, what do you think about that move?
Well, I think the president needs to have the opportunity to get people in, whether they be short-term, whether they be recess appointments for the next year, or permanent appointments. And the Senate blocking that maneuver, blocking the president's power to do that, I think is unfortunate, because it's going to make it hard for the president to fill many of the positions that are still open at the Justice Department. And potentially it'll happen. What will happen is other positions are going to just stay open. I mean, you look at the Senate docket now, there are quite a few nominations pending on the Senate calendar that may not be resolved by the end of the year.
If I could bounce to, well, there are many subjects I want to talk about, but let's talk about the recess appointments, because, you know, I work on Capitol Hill, so I watch the process going on there, and it's quite a show.
Has this been something done in the past before for other presidents?
Sure,
there
have been attempts to block recess appointments, but, you know, this time it's being carried out, first of all, by Senate leadership, Senator Harry Reid, who used to be the consummate compromiser. You know, I mean, this is not a guy who would actually usually used to step up to the plate and start battling against his opponents and would do something like blocking recess appointments. Harry Reid has turned into an entirely different leader ever since the 2006 elections, to the point where he is just taking on Bush right and left, and he's going to block Bush when it comes to making some of these appointments. Bush, you know, he had worked out agreements with Bush earlier in some of the earlier recess appointments, and Bush just violated what he felt was their informal agreements, and went ahead and appointed a number of recess appointees who were very offensive to Reid's position and the Democratic Party position. John Bolton, Susan Dudley, Sam Fox. I mean, these are some that are just sort of outrageous appointments. And so now what he's done is Reid has to call the Senate into session once every 3 days as we go through this recess. And he's appointed poor Senator Jim Webb to show up there in the morning every 3 days, bang the gavel, sit around, have a cup of coffee with some of the staffers who are around there.
Because there's nobody else there.
Because there's no one else there. And then he just walks away. It's actually kind of fun to watch.
This is a sign, I think.
We're getting ready to go to a break, and we will continue this discussion as far as where we're at, and especially this recent recess move by Congress. We will return after this short break. Welcome back to American Dream. I'm your host, Tina Richards. The shakeup in the U.S. concerning the Bush administration and Congress is our subject tonight. Earlier today, we went out and asked some people what they thought about this administration and about what is happening with the shakeup in his last 13 months.
I believe that this administration has been an incredible catastrophe. Our country is in a lot of trouble right now. We're very seriously financially leveraged to the Chinese government. I believe that we are in an incredibly weak position as an international power. I don't believe we've ever been this weak in modern history. I believe that what's happening now in the White House is sort of symptomatic of it's like a house of cards that's basically collapsed, and I believe we're seeing something that's in its death throes in terms of the political base and the political power that the Republican Party has in Washington. However, I think it's going to take much longer for the country to recover, and there's a lot of weakness among the Democratic candidates, so I don't see the U.S. getting out of its problems anytime soon.
I think it's very regular for, it's very ordinary for a lot of the cabinet members to start resigning and finding new jobs in the public sector. Now, sort of, they're getting out now while the getting's good, basically. And I think Bush is starting to look at what his legacy is going to be, and he's looking to come up with something positive for his legacy and to be known for. I see him now trying to become Clinton and do the whole Middle East peace thing, and it's kind of sad. But you know, if that's what it's going to take for him to do something positive, then okay, we're ready for it.
I think it happens pretty much with any administration. I think that you always have people leave for, I mean, this is America, right? So I think that people leave for financial reasons. I think Tony Snow left because of financial reasons, and he was pretty clear about it. So, I think that's why Trent Lott's leaving. So there's reasons for him to leave that are going to be financially beneficial for him. So, you know, it's just, I think it happens, and there's nothing you can do about it, you know, and hopefully they just get replaced with some people that can, you know, carry on the mission and hope to accomplish what, you know, what the president wants to accomplish.
It seems to me that if all of these people seem to be Republicans are resigning, something seems to be happening. I don't think it's going to disturb Bush that much because he doesn't have very much longer anyway. But these other people, I think that they realize that whatever agenda they've been trying to push is not going to work and it's a lost cause. Their resigning just shows that what they're doing is not what people want. And the sooner these people who are doing things they shouldn't be doing are gone, the better off we'll all be.
And I'd like to go ahead and part of what they were saying, some, this is just typical, this is not, and to finish up with the talking about the recess appointments.
Well, I think that what's going on or not going on with the recess appointments speaks to the very high degree of political polarization that exists in Washington and throughout the country now, because the polarization between the two political parties, between the executive branch led by President Bush and the Democratic congressional leadership, means that there is little, if any, trust between them. And therefore, the Democratic leadership is unwilling to allow President Bush to make a discretionary appointment.
So are we that far on lack of trust between the two?
Absolutely. This is one of the most prominent facts about American politics today, that the two parties have almost nothing in common, that the middle ground that used to exist has been hollowed out. The kinds of conversations that used to exist in the Congress and between the Congress and the executive branch are much less frequent and much less productive than they used to be. And so the recess appointment controversy is just the tip of a much bigger political iceberg, in my opinion.
So you think there's no trust between the Congress and the president?
I would agree. I think we live in a very
Why
partisan...
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, look at what's happened over the years. I mean, we've had Nancy Pelosi, who's Speaker of the House, make a trip to Syria, a diplomatic trip, which is more in the realm of something that should be done by the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. And it shows that the Speaker of the House didn't have the trust and didn't have the confidence in the president to do that.
So it's Pelosi's fault that there's no trust?
No, I'm saying that's one example of the highly charged partisan rhetoric and activities that are going on. You've seen Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, say that the war is lost in Iraq, already declaring that the war is lost, a war that we are fighting right now, that President Bush is leading as commander-in-chief. There is not much common ground. I agree. There's no common ground in between the House and Senate leadership and the executive branch. The executive branch has taken a hard-line stance on a lot of these issues, and the Democrats in Congress have taken a hard-line stance right back.
When they were talking about Bolton, they knew that he couldn't get through confirmation, mm-hmm. so he waited for recess and then appointed him. Didn't traditionally recess appointments used to be for when Congress was in recess and a position needed to be filled, not an in-run around Congress? And
well,
would that
the Senate also has been abusing some of the rules. I mean, many of these nominees have been filibustered, meaning that you need a supermajority to pass these nominees. We're not talking about nominees being defeated.
That's just what's being done now this year.
Sure,
the
right.
Senate is, the minorities in the Senate is now doing.
Right, and but you're seeing many of the nominees that came up, they're being filibustered, meaning that the Democrats would block the allowance of 60 votes, which is a supermajority, to pass these nominees. And yes, Republicans are fighting back and are filibustering pieces of legislation that they don't see moving forward, and they don't want to see the president veto anyway. So there is a highly charged atmosphere. I mean, we're having a House and Senate that's passing pieces of legislation like the health care bill for children that they know the president won't sign. And once the president vetoes it, it comes back to Congress, and Congress attempts to override, can't override, and you're seeing back and forth. We're seeing this on spending bills where Congress is purposely sending spending bills to the president that they know that he's declared he's going to veto. So I think this is a battle, and it's all about 2008. I mean, what's going on right now in Washington, D.C., many of the messages that are being sent by Congress are, if you can give Washington more Democrats and maybe a Democrat president, some of these issues will be signed into law. So I think a lot of what's going on right now in Congress, the fact that they're passing pieces of legislation that they know the president won't sign, are playing politics, and it is an indication that we are already well into the next election, and we're almost past the Bush administration in many respects.
So is this just the politics, or is it the Democrats being an opposition party as they're elected?
Well, it certainly is politics, but I wouldn't call it just. This is one point apparently we all agree upon. There is no trust right now in the federal government on
Why?
Capitol Hill
Why do you
or
think
with
there
the White
no
House.
Trust?
It's an exceedingly polarized federal government we have at this point. The Bush administration, in its first 6 years or so, actually had such universal control over the federal government, they could just simply ignore what the Democrats wanted.
Is that part of the signing statements also with?
Part of all the legislation that was going on when Tom DeLay was, for instance, the powerhouse in representing the Republicans in the House of Representatives, he would actually draft legislation through the night, not let the Democrats even see it until about 15, 20, 30 minutes beforehand, and plop it on the floor of the House and then force a vote in this kind of legislation. The Republican administration, both in Congress and in the White House, had such firm control over the federal government that they did not have to respect the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has gotten very angry and very distrustful.
So now has it become, you did this to us, we're going to do it to you?
It isn't so much as tit for tat as it is trying to get something through. Let me give a brief little anecdotal story of the lobby and ethics reform legislation that I was working on. The Republicans in the Senate and the House kept kind of indicating they were going to go for it, they were going to support this. They just kept wanting to modify it. The Democrats are pushing hard. We need some meaningful lobbying and ethics reform. And they kept negotiating, kept compromising with Republicans until finally they had a bill that was passing both the House and the Senate, or should have at that point, and suddenly one senator, Jim DeMint, just put a hold on it and wasn't going to let it go through for unrelated purposes. And so at that point, Harry Reid, who I want to emphasize is the consummate compromiser. I mean, this guy is not one of your, you know, battle kind of guys. He just finally got so sick and tired of what the Republicans were doing that he took the bill away from the Senate, took it away from the House, worked with Nancy Pelosi, who's the head of the House. They met essentially in secret, rewrote a bill so that there would be unanimous agreement between, universal agreement between the House bill and the Senate bill, so it would not have to go to conference committee, where the Republicans could then put a hold on it again, and reintroduce the bill about 4 days later, brand new bill. Democrats universally supported it in the House and in the Senate, and it became law. I mean, that was the only way the Democrats could get that kind of meaningful legislation through, was to actually lock the Republicans out of the entire process.
That sounds like the ethics bill was passed using unethical means and drafted in secret and kept away from the House and the Senate to deliberate on it. And many times these conference committees, they get together, their members, obviously the majority has control, so the Democrats had control in both the House and the Senate and much of the drafting of this. So,
well, when he spoke of Tom DeLay and some of the tactics were used during 2000 up to 2006, I do remember stories coming out that there was meetings being held and they wouldn't tell the Democrats where the meeting was at in these conference committees.
But now we're seeing it on the shoes on the other foot. We're seeing a House that's very intolerant of dissent. The only thing that is allowed by the minority on behalf of the minority now is one motion to instruct. Bills are brought up on the floor. There are no amendments allowed on these bills that are brought up in the House. So it was funny to see the Democrats come into power saying that they were going to change the way things are done in the House and the Senate. And we've seen the exact opposite. We saw it in the immigration bill, where a bill was drafted in secret by members of the administration, Ted Kennedy, a bipartisan coalition in the Senate and members of the administration. And they actually took a bill that nobody had seen and put it on the floor by using it as an amendment and putting it on the floor 2 days after it was drafted.
But it came through the Bush administration, so wouldn't that show cooperation?
Well, it was cooperation on an issue that was very much a Democrat issue, more so than a Republican issue. The Bush administration agrees with Democrats on the issue of comprehensive immigration reform. The Bush administration wanted to give amnesty to many of the illegal immigrants in the country, and it's not something that was widely supported
by Republicans. So wasn't it a sign where they were working together and having a level of trust?
Well, it was one example of the Bush administration. I wouldn't say Republicans. I'd say Republicans as a whole did not think that the Bush administration did the correct thing on immigration reform. As you've seen with poll numbers, the poll numbers on allowing illegal immigrants to have driver's licenses is overwhelmingly disapproved of in this country. And immigration has shot up as an issue from being an issue that people talked about quite a bit to one of the most important issues that people are going to consider in this election. And it's not going to be on the side of Ted Kennedy and President Bush on what they negotiated to just forgive people that came into this country illegally and are working in this country illegally.
Let's refocus on the sort of the personnel issue for just a minute, because I do agree with something that one of your guests, Mr. Hellam, said earlier, and that is the very large number of resignations of Republicans in both the Senate and the House of Representatives does send a kind of signal to the party and to the country. And I am familiar with this signal because 1994 was a huge victory. Election victory for the Republican Party. And something like 70 new Republican House members flooded in. And in the 2 years after that, it was a period of great enthusiasm and activity among Republicans, but equally significantly, it was a period of higher than average resignation among Democrats. And there's a reason for that. First of all, it's no fun being in the minority. You lose control of the committees, you have a much smaller staff, fewer resources, much less influence over legislation. But in addition, those Democrats were saying, we don't think that we're going to be in the majority again for a while. We don't expect to regain power.
And
my thesis is that the Republicans who are resigning are saying, in effect, yes, we have our own personal reasons, but we lack confidence that we're going to be in the majority again anytime soon. Now, they may outsmart themselves. If things really go well for the Republicans next year, there might be a Republican majority in at least one House. If you're asking me for my prediction as a political scientist, I doubt it, but it's not impossible. But I can assure you that if Senator Trent Lott had really believed that the Republicans were on the verge of regaining control of the Senate and that he might be Senate Majority Leader in 14 or 15 months, I think he would have thought three times before resigning so abruptly.
Well, do you think that partly of his, and going into the ethics part of it, do you think that the rumors that Trent Lott basically resigned because he didn't want to be constricted to the 2 years that this ethics bill now restricts people from Congress going into the revolving door of the lobbyists,
right,
or that it has more to deal with he doesn't see the Republicans getting into power come next year.
First of all, it has more to do with the political realities of what's going to happen in the 2008 elections. I want to emphasize, again, this is not turnover as normal. This is a mass exodus turnover. This is something maybe we have seen, something close to it in 1994 when the Democrats started believing there were no prospects for a long time.
So you think we have
to
look in conjunction with both the Republican congressional exodus
and the
Bush administration together as a whole, not just looking one as a part?
Absolutely. The Republicans just see the writing on the wall in 2008 when it comes, by the way, especially to congressional elections. I do want to qualify this for the White House. But when it comes to congressional elections, I mean, the estimates now range from the Democrats are going to gain so many seats in the Senate that they may have about a 59-vote majority. And they're going to gain many more in the House, an unpredictable number, you know, at this point. And so it looks like Republican prospects, at least, you know, in Congress are fairly dim. And what happened with, particularly with Trent Lott, you know, Trent Lott has been around for decades. You know, this is not a guy who
35 years.
This is not a guy who wants to leave Congress.
Right.
But however, he sees that he's going to be relegated to an increasingly minority role, and probably one in which
He just won back and redeemed himself with winning back his position as minority whip after.
That's right, to serve another full turn. And so 1 year into it, he suddenly pulls out, and he's pulling out one day before what changes? The new revolving door restriction kicks in. That's the only thing that significantly changes between December 30th and January 1.
Revolving door, if you could just explain the revolving door.
The revolving door restriction, the Senate in the ethics package agreed that there was just too much of the spinning of the revolving door where former senators suddenly leave public service and take lobbying jobs with the very same special interests who are lobbying them, who have business pending before them while they're in office. It can be a very, very effective lobbyist tool to try to win over members of Congress by, you know, without even working out a quid pro quo, but just sort of letting them know, if we like you, you know, there's a $2 million a year job waiting for you over here on K Street. And that's a lot of incentive to you know, pass certain types of legislation that a special interest group wants. What has happened in the Senate is they have set up a new rule that would prohibit former members of the Senate to take those lobbying jobs for 2 years after they leave the Senate. But this rule doesn't kick in until the stroke of midnight on December 31st. And Trent Lott is leaving the Senate on December 30th. So he goes under the old rules still.
And Brian, I'd like to get your input as to looking at this as a whole package, mm-hmm. both what Congress and 18 members of Congress on the Republican side leaving, plus coinciding with the members out of the Bush administration leaving.
Well, I mean, you have some individual cases where members in the Senate at least are resigning for specific reasons. Obviously, Larry Craig's been in a controversy. He's resigning. Chuck Hagel.
Is he resigning? Because I know he
said
he was resigning, and then he said he was going to.
I'm sorry, he's not running for re-election.
Because he was going to resign, then he decided to continue in.
Yes, I misstated that. But you look at Chuck Hagel deciding not to run for re-election out of Nebraska. You look at Colorado. Wayne Allard pledged to serve two terms. He self-term limited himself. He's leaving. Senator Domenici of New Mexico is somebody who probably, for health reasons, has decided to move on and resign. So you have some specific members of the Senate, not all Republicans. There are six Republicans that are choosing not to run for re-election not going to be back in the Senate, which are definitely causing problems for Republicans. I mean, many of those seats are swing states. Many of those seats are going to be tough to hold. The Republicans have 22 seats that will be up for re-election in the next election, and the Democrats don't have nearly that many, and many of the Republican seats
are safe districts.
Yes, the only potential.
But now combine it with President Bush and the administration. I mean, from Rumsfeld, as everybody said, was basically thrown out, to the recent Townsend resignation.
Sure. Well, that's an indication, I think, that I think you don't need to make it bigger than it actually is. I mean, obviously, a lot of these Republicans are leaving because they don't see themselves coming back into power. That may be a calculation on the part of Trent Lott. I mean, he was always in leadership. I think he was the first member ever to be elected whip, majority whip in the House and in the Senate. He's one of the few individuals who's ever been in leadership in the House and the Senate and risen to the level of majority leader in the Senate.
Well, was that part of the vindication? Because actually Bush was one of the ones leading for him to be taken out of the majority position after he made some controversial remarks.
Yes.
And this went in contrary to what actually Bush had advocated for just a couple of years before.
Well, he came back in, and I presume that he is leaving as a result of the fact that he probably doesn't see himself in the near future, because in the Senate especially, Republicans are going to have a very difficult time taking back the majority. They'd have to win two seats, and there aren't two seats there to win. There are many seats that they may lose. So I think the Senate's unique in the fact that more Republicans are up than Democrats. More Republican seats are in danger because of some of the members that are leaving in states that are swing states. So you're seeing a situation in the Senate where there's a very minimal chance.
And they're leaving because of various reasons, not because of...
I think that's part of the calculation. I think part of it is because many of these members, like John Warner, doesn't see himself staying in the Senate, waiting it out for 4 or 6 years. Till Republicans can have the opportunity to potentially take back the Senate. I think many of the members who have been around for a long time that have been chairman of the committees, like Senator Domenici, who is chairman of the very powerful Energy Committee, he's not willing to wait around until Republicans come back into power.
Earlier you just said it was because of health reasons that you thought he was retiring.
No, I think that he is.
Because of the...
I think he does have health reasons why he's retiring also, but he might have hung in there and stuck it out. I mean, we have many members of the Senate that have health reasons. We have obviously a few years ago we had a senator that cracked the 100 mark, who was over 100 years old. So many of these senators have health problems as a result of being rather elderly, but still being reelected to the Senate. So I think that's a calculation.
Professor Goldstone, do you think that it has health that factors into this quite a bit or not?
Well, I recognized each one of those individual stories, but I do agree that many of those individual decisions might well have come out differently if there was an expectation that by January of 2009, I will regain the chairmanship of my old committee or gain a new committee chairmanship or become Senate Majority Leader. Those are very powerful positions. Those are very strong incentives. And if you have no immediate expectation, then either spending more time with your wife in your declining years, or taking better care of yourself physically, or making a lot more money, or enjoying life. There is more to life than politics, after all. Then those reasons start to seem more important if power seems more distant.
And relate that to also the Bush administration.
Well, it is a lot easier if you're a senior appointed official in the executive branch. It is a lot easier to get a new job from a position of strength when your president still has some power in Washington. If you wait until the very end and then there's a total turnover of power in Washington.
And is that what you think that they're expecting?
Well, it's like everything else in life. You have to calculate the risks, the probability that the worst case will actually come to pass, and then try to protect yourself against it. And I know when I first came to Washington in the early 1980s, I heard stories from members of the Carter administration. You know, Jimmy Carter, of course, was defeated for re-election by Ronald Reagan. And these were people who had lost everything because they couldn't get a job. There was no one left to help them. They weren't seen as wielders of power.
Jimmy Carter's term ending after the 4 years.
It ended very badly, and those who stayed until the very end, and you're much more likely to stay until the end of the first term because you don't know that's the end of the president's administration until the voters tell you it is. At that point, many of them were unemployed for 6 months, 9 months, even a year before landing new positions. Nobody wants to go through that kind of difficult transition, and so it just makes sense to take advantage of an incumbent president while he's still around to help you.
Well, we're getting ready to wrap up. 15 seconds.
I would like to wrap up with something that we've got to emphasize. That the latest poll shows that 74% of Americans believe this country is on the wrong track. And they take a look at the Bush administration on these three policies: the war, the economy and health care, and they've just concluded that this administration, and they affiliate that with the Republican Party, has failed America. And not only do the voters feel that way, but members of Congress and those even in the executive branch understand that the voters are probably going to vote accordingly.
Well, President Bush's approval ratings were at an all-time low. Congressional approval ratings have never been as low as they are now, and Congress is dominated by the Democrats. So I think the American people are very discouraged by Washington, D.C. They don't think Washington, D.C. is doing anything to solve their problems. I analyze these poll numbers to mean that the voters out there are very volatile. They're not sure what they're going to do. I don't know which party they're going to take it out on. They may take it out on both parties. They may stay home. But the indication is now that the poll numbers for Congress and the level of satisfaction on the part of the American people is extremely low, and I think they're blaming both Republicans and Democrats for not getting much done.
And I would like to go ahead and thank you once again for coming, Dr. Craig Holman with the Public Citizens Congress Lodge.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Delightful to be here.
And Brian Darling, Director, U.S. Senate Relations and Government Relations, the Heritage Foundation. Thank you very much. And Professor William Golston, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute. Thank you very much for joining me. And thank you for joining me here on American Dream. Until next time.